On Thursday, a federal judge in New Orleans lowered the boom on the oil giant BP. He ruled that BP was grossly negligent for the Deepwater Horizon explosion, which killed 11 and sent oil spewing into the Gulf of Mexico for 3 months. Five states were directly affected by the spill. Louisiana took a direct hit. But the BP disaster was only the latest environmental crisis to affect its shores. Louisiana's coastline has been disappearing over the past century, thousands of acres now underwater. For local communities, it means a way of life is disappearing along with the wetlands. Fishing guide Ryan Lambert joins us from his fishing lodge on the lower Mississippi Delta in Louisiana to tell us more about what's happening there. Good to have you with us, Ryan.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. Now, I know you've been fishing in this area for more than 30 years. Tell me, first of all, what was it like back then when you first started fishing?
There was a lot more land. You'd have to navigate from one bayou to another bay all the way until you hit the Gulf of Mexico, 6.3 miles from the dock. Now, today, you could turn your boat towards the Gulf of Mexico and never hit a piece of land. It's all gone. It's 6.3 miles of land completely gone.
Wow. Now, as that was happening, Ryan, were you aware that it was happening? When did you become aware that the land was really changing?
You could see it on a daily basis. It would sink or disappear, or islands that you fish would be gone the next season. And over 34 years of guiding, it really takes a toll to see it happen. And I've really become passionate about coastal restoration ever since.
I was going to ask if you and other people started really questioning what was going on and why it was going on and investigating it.
Well, you know, everybody always knew that it was happening, but no one really knew and paid enough attention to it to get a big sense of how to fix it. After the 27 flood, the great flood of the Mississippi River, they built all these levees and shut off the sediment and fresh water to our estuary. Therefore, salt water will come in and kill all the freshwater species of grasses and trees. And the next time the tide would come, it would sink away into the tide. And then the oil companies came and they started putting their pipelines, and that just accelerated the issue because it let their salt water come inside even quicker. But there's nothing to replace it because the life-sustaining sediment and fresh water from the Mississippi that overflowed every spring no longer exist.
How has that changed the way of life there?
Well, you know where I fish right here. You can go out, and if you get on your GPS, you can see where the old bayous used to be. And you can see where these camps used to be. People were born and raised in those camps. That was a way of life. Everyone in Louisiana, you know, had a camp to go to. They lived there, and they trapped, and they hunted, and they fished out of them. Now it's skeletons, just pilings out in the open water. It's a whole heritage lost. We've lost 2,000 square miles of land in Louisiana in the last 90 years. That's the size of Delaware. If the state of Delaware just dropped off into the ocean, you think anybody would notice?
Well, how concerned are people getting now about it? I mean, are people starting to organize? And
well, the state's got a coastal master plan, and it's a 50-year, $50 billion pipe dream if we don't have the funding for it. We will get some from the Restore Act and the BP fines from NERDA and the Clean Water Act that will come here. And if we use it wisely, we can start getting this done. You know we can't save everything, but we're going to have to pick and choose what we can save. Because for every mile of marsh you have between the Gulf and civilization, that knocks the storm surge of a hurricane down 1 foot. Hurricane Katrina caused $120 billion worth of damage. So that was, what, 7, 8 years ago? It's probably 6 times worse with the lack of marsh to protect them now than it was when Katrina happened. It's just a matter of time, just one hurricane away, we will no longer be able to inhabit this area. And that goes for New Orleans as well. People that live in the city, they are so disconnected with Mother Nature. They live their lives, but they don't know what's outside there lurking, if you will.
What about levees? I mean, levees play a role in this, and yet levees are very protective in that area. I mean, you have a levee near your house. You wouldn't want that taken down, would you?
You cannot have protection without restoration, because if these waves are banging on the levee, it's going to break. It's going to breach. You have to have something on the other side of these levees in which to break these waves and energy down for that levee to maintain a level. And that's what we're learning now. And it's a learning process, and we're going to learn, but we have to really do it quick because our lives literally depend on it in this area.
Ryan Lambert is a fishing guide in Buras, Louisiana. Ryan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
No, you're very welcome. Thank you for your time.
Global warming is something the planet will be wrestling with in the years to come, and there's some news this morning. The UN's weather agency says the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is linked to warming, reached a record level in 2013. In their annual report, the World Meteorological Organization says the increase from 2012 to 2013 was the biggest yearly increase in three decades.
This could be bad news for humans and also bad news for birds. A study out today from the National Audubon Society suggests that nearly half the bird species in the United States and Canada, nearly half, are at risk of extinction if no action is taken to protect them.
David Yarnold is Audubon's president and CEO, and he said the seven-year study helped scientists understand the link between where birds live and the climate conditions they need to survive.
The report looks at the underlying causes of climate, things like temperature and precipitation and humidity. And then we overlaid on top of that decades worth of bird census data so that we can correlate what's happened with climate with what's happened with birds.
So certain species of birds need temperatures, humidity, these things to sort of be at certain levels. And if they change, these species just can't exist?
That's exactly right. So what happens when 40 species of Western songbirds keep having to fly higher and higher up Western mountains to find places to live? What happens when Minnesota's loons find that the weather is just too warm for them? They may not be able to fledge, they may not mate, they may not be able to find familiar food. It's a little bit like going to a new place where you're not sure whether there would be water or power. Do you think that you'll be able to survive there? That's the question that this report poses. For 314 species, we know that there's a great probability that they're going to be facing very different climate futures, and their outcomes are really unsure.
So let me just zero in if we can. You mentioned loons in Minnesota. This is the species, the common loon, and I think we have a little bit of tape to play if people might, you know, even recognize this. So describe this species for me, if you can.
Yeah, so it's a lovely waterfowl. It's a bird that has been associated with Minnesota and with some other places in the Northeast for a very long time. And what the Audubon report says is that it's going to get too warm on a consistent basis for the loon to be able to spend its summers in Minnesota.
I could imagine, you know, if we lose some bird species in the United States, others from farther south will come up and replace them.
It's not likely that birds are going to migrate from Central and South America to replace them. Maybe over very long periods of time that could happen. But remember, what we're talking about are changes at a pace and at a scale that we've never seen before. These are the kinds of changes to habitat that have taken tens of thousands of years in the past. And what worries me is that these are the changes that my 9-month-old grandson could see in his lifetime. We're talking about things that are happening now and through the end of the century. This year in Southern California, 90 to 95% of raptor nests failed. There were no baby raptors because of drought. These things are happening now. This isn't some distant future.
David, the headline that the survival of half our bird species could be at risk is certainly attention-grabbing. In the debate over climate change, there are some who complain that sometimes there can be an alarmist quality to reports. What can you tell me about this report that would respond to that sort of question?
There are models, there are forecasts that are far more extreme than this report. If anything, this report is conservative. At every step of the way, we took great care to not overstate data or conclusions. Nothing would make us happier than to be wrong about the fate of many of these birds.
David, we really appreciate you coming on the program. Thanks so much.
You bet.
That's David Yarnold. He's president and CEO of the National Audubon Society. And we should mention that common loon bird call you heard was given to us by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology.
Even though Michigan is surrounded by more than 20% of the world's fresh water, fish farming is largely unheard of there. This summer, though, the aquaculture industry there took a step forward, and that has touched off a debate over the appropriateness of fish farming on the Great Lakes. Peter Payette of Interlaken Public Radio has the story.
There's only one company in Michigan that raises fish for restaurants and grocery stores in large volumes. It's a family business on a few acres near Harrietta, Michigan, population 143. There's more than 500,000 fish here of various sizes, mostly rainbow trout. The largest ones weigh a pound and a half. Dan Vogler feeds them by hand, spraying pellets across the water, causing the surface to explode. Vogler wants to see more aquaculture in Michigan. He says with billions of people looking for fresh food, the state has an opportunity.
Not only an opportunity, but we have a responsibility to use our natural resources, use them responsibly to grow food.
Vogler's farm is on a creek that feeds the Manistee River on its way to Lake Michigan. This summer, his company received a state permit to develop a second operation, also inland, on the Asabo River. That's a popular trout fishing destination, and conservation groups are now challenging that permit, saying the state's not doing enough to protect the river. Dan Vogler says his operation causes no harm, and if Michigan wants to produce seafood, this is the right way to do it.
The reality is that the native Great Lakes wild fishery is in a state of general collapse. So if we're going to have locally available fish, it has to come from fish farms.
Even though Michigan borders every Great Lake but Ontario, there are few commercial fishermen left here. Half a century ago, the state decided that the lake should be used for recreational fishing, and state officials stocked them with Pacific salmon. In the decades that followed, sport fishing became big business here, all up and down the coast. That's why Howard Tanner was upset by a federal report this year suggesting that Michigan allow fish farms to operate on the Great Lakes. It was Tanner who ran the state's fish program in the 1960s when those first salmon were stocked in Lakes Michigan and Superior. He calls fish farming dangerous and maintains there is just no room for large fish pens in these lakes.
The net pen culture would be in the places most favorable to other recreational and leisure time activities. They want deep water close to shore. It doesn't mix with the sport fishery that is there.
One of the problems is fish waste adds nutrients, like phosphorus, to the water. Biologists say too much of it can harm the ecosystem and increase the kind of algae that contaminated Toledo's water supply this summer. Howard Tanner says fish farms that are in the ocean can deal with that waste, but not in a lake.
They have a flush for their system. It's called a tide. It flushes their waste products away into salt water. They're talking about no tides, and there's no possible way for them to treat their waste.
There are some commercial fish pens on the Canadian side of Lake Huron, raising mainly rainbow trout. And operators there say the concerns over nutrient loading are exaggerated, and that it might even help wild fish populations. Mike Rennie is a research biologist in Winnipeg and says an experiment done in a small lake in Canada did produce a benefit from fish farming.
Overall, the lake trout population in the lake seemed to actually do better during the course of the experiment. So the population estimates actually went up. Growth rates for the fish went up.
There are no proposals yet for fish farming in the Michigan waters of the Great Lakes. And judging by the controversy over expansion plans of just one inland operation, any proposal would likely face fierce opposition. For NPR News, I'm Peter Payette in Interlaken, Michigan.
All is not well with the nation's birds. The most comprehensive study ever of birds in America is out today. It says many populations are in steep decline, even as others are doing well. NPR's Christopher Joyce has this story on the state of the birds.
Scientists from the federal government, universities, and conservation groups, 23 organizations in all, spent years on the state of the birds study. They looked at birds from different habitats. Shorebirds like red knots, grassland dwellers like meadowlarks, and birds that live in deserts and in wetlands. The upshot?
If we were to give our nation's birds a report card, it would be somewhere in the C range.
Peter Mara is a migratory bird specialist who works at the Smithsonian Institution's National Zoo in Washington, D.C. He helped write the study. The birds in trouble, the report lists 230 species on its so-called watch list, are in decline. That's especially true for those that live in forests and grassland areas, like the pinyon jay and longspurs, or in arid lands, like the sage grouse. but numbers for other kinds of birds are on the upswing.
Several of the coastal birds are indeed success stories.
Coastal birds like turnstones and oyster catchers, for example. Wetland birds that were once in danger are now doing better too, like wood ducks and ibis. That's partly due to recent laws that have protected and restored their wetland habitats.
These populations come back when we create the habitat.
But Mara says bringing birds back from dangerous decline is sort of an admission of failure. The report emphasizes that it's better to focus on birds that aren't yet in decline and keep them that way. At the National Zoo, Mara has netted a catbird. It's gray and nondescript. Catbirds are not in trouble, but Mara says that was true of the American passenger pigeon, too, once numbering in the billions, then hunted and collected to extinction 100 years ago.
Our job should be preserving abundance, keeping species common when they're common, and not let the passenger pigeon example rule the day.
Most ducks, for example, are still abundant. Ken Rosenberg, he's a bird biologist at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and an author of the report, says hunters as well as conservationists deserve credit.
We've put a tremendous amount of resources and money into wetland and waterfowl conservation because of the hunters who contribute financially.
Hunters help pay to protect wetlands where ducks live and breed. But Rosenberg says other bird habitats don't get much respect.
An opposite situation might be grasslands and arid lands that are mostly considered to be sort of wastelands to a lot of people.
But that's where lots of songbirds are in trouble, birds like pipits and thrashers. Of course, many species of birds have adapted as humans rearranged the landscape, and some people say those that can't, well, species have always been going extinct.
Sure, we can exist and we can have all the nature disappear around us, but, you know, what kind of life will that be?
One way to keep the disappearances to a minimum is to track more birds to find out where they go and to protect those places. At the National Zoo, Peter Mara holds a black-crowned night heron that his crew has netted. Last year, Mara put a tracking device on this bird's back.
Last year, we determined for the first time that of three birds that we tracked, one stayed in Georgetown. I was convinced it was in a dumpster eating prosciutto ends. The other two headed down to Florida.
Florida is a crucial stopover for migrating birds like these, and it's a state where bird habitat is disappearing fast. It's the kind of place, the report says, that birds both common and endangered will need to survive.
So why don't we let them go? All right, buddy.
Here we go. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Edwin Chota wanted to stop illegal loggers from operating on his community's land in the Peruvian Amazon. His efforts gained international attention and also death threats. This week, we learned he and three other community leaders were killed and dismembered at the beginning of the month. The news of the murders was delayed because of the remote location where they occurred. People in the area say illegal loggers are suspected in the killings. Here to discuss Chota's life and legacy is his friend David Salisbury. He's a professor of geography and the environment at the University of Richmond. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
First, I want to say sorry for the loss of your friend. Can you tell us a little bit about how you met?
I first met Edwin a decade ago when I was doing my doctoral dissertation research in the remote borderlands of Peru. It's a community of Asheninka indigenous folk, people practicing a largely subsistence lifestyle with agriculture, hunting, fishing, but also extracting some hardwoods so that they could buy much-needed supplies such as clothing, soap, medicine. But unfortunately, it was also an area that was filled with illegal loggers who are actively looking to take as much timber out as possible.
These hardwoods that you mentioned, mahogany and cedar, right? I mean, how widespread is illegal logging?
Illegal logging is very widespread in all the Amazon, and particularly in Peru. Commercially sized trees of mahogany and tropical cedar are essentially gone. And now the loggers are moving down a list of valuable hardwoods.
I was reading that an old-growth mahogany tree can get upwards of $11,000, right, per tree.
Yes, that would be what you might get in a lumber yard in a developed country. But, of course, once you know it's parceled out into furniture and other goods, you're talking about up over $100,000.
But the U.S. does have a ban on these kinds of imports, does it not?
It does. There's an international ban on the traffic of mahogany, but they seem to reach not only the United States but also Europe. China is increasingly a player. So there seems to be a way to circumvent the control of these particular species.
Tell us about Edwin Chota's activism, because he wasn't an official investigator. He didn't have a lot of resources. I mean, how did he actually go about trying to stop this activity?
Edwin was irrepressible. He had incredible energy, incredible charisma, and a real sense of right and wrong.
There was one story we heard about him actually floating down the river with the illegal timber.
Well, what he would do at times is he would notice when the timber was being taken out, floated downstream, and he would follow it until it got to the sawmill, where he would confront the sawmill owners, the loggers themselves, and get the authorities to seize the timber. This is not an easy thing to do, to motivate the authorities to fulfill their functions and also to confront these well-armed, extremely powerful individuals. But he was unafraid.
David Salisbury, what's been the response in the region or from Peru's government?
To date, there's been very little response from the Peruvian government. In fact, no authorities have actually arrived at the scene of the crime. However, today, just across the border in the Axeninca village of Apucha.
And this is the border of Brazil.
This is in Brazil. So the Brazilian Axeninca, the cousins of the people who were murdered, Edwin, Jorge, Francisco, and Leoncio, are moving across the border to recover the bodies and ensure the safety of the people of Soweto. Because Edwin was not the only person with a death threat on his head. The entire community is threatened by the illegal loggers, and now they've lost their charismatic leader.
David Salisbury, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
David Salisbury, he's a professor of geography and the environment at the University of Richmond. He was speaking to us about his friend, Edwin Chota, an outspoken Peruvian opponent of illegal logging, who was killed earlier this month.